This is an ABC podcast.
There is something curious about a woman's anger. A spark can set alight a whole forest, once wet and green. And it burns and burns, fueled by the memory of past injustices, borne not just by them, but the women before them. Their mothers and grandmothers, sisters and aunts, friends and maids, the women in stories, witches, princesses, queens, and goddesses.
This is The Book Show. Hello, I'm Claire Nichols. And that was Anindita Ghosh reading from her debut novel, The Illuminated. I really connected with this idea of an anger fanned by generations of women. Later on the show, you are going to meet Australian writers Ben Hobson and Simone Lazarou. And right now, Anindita Ghosh. She is a journalist and author based in Mumbai, in India. Her debut novel is about a mother and daughter, Shashi and Tara, both of whom are negotiating new lives outside the shadows of powerful men. The book is called The Illuminated. I loved it. Anindita, thank you for that reading.
Thank you, Claire. It's such a pleasure to be here with you on this call.
Let's talk a bit about your writing life. You studied linguistics at university. What sparked your interest in language?
Most Indians are multilingual, and I'm multilingual as well. I grew up in a Bengali family, but we speak English and Hindi. I studied in English. I grew up in a different part of India from where I was born. So the local language here is Marathi in Bombay. So I understand Marathi as well. You know, when you're growing up kind of surrounded by so much language, and with language, there is the politics of language. Who speaks what language gives them a certain power and privilege. So I think I've always been curious about these questions. And I did my undergrad in media studies. I did journalism, and I interned every year, every summer. And when I graduated, there were all these jobs, but I kind of felt I hadn't really had a proper education, and I wanted to study something, go deep into a subject. So I studied linguistics, and I really fancied that I would do a PhD in linguistics and, you know, be one of those social linguists who go deep into forests and discover new languages. Alas, it seems most of the languages have been discovered already. So that didn't happen. But I think it's taught me, you know, kind of a way to look at not just language, but linguistics gives you tools to look at even culture and art and, even maybe perhaps fiction in a certain way. It gives you tools, analytical tools to look at things around you. So I really value those 2 years, that I studied linguistics.
Has your writing always been in English?
It has. I speak around, three Indian languages. I understand a few more, but for various reasons, including colonialism, English is the only language I can really read and enjoy fiction in. And it's definitely the only language I can write in. Yeah, I have consumed a lot of Bengali and Hindi poetry and literature orally. My grandmother used to read out Bengali stories, but English is the only language, that I can read and write in.
Mm. You became a journalist. You were features editor for Vogue India. Is that as glamorous a job as I am imagining it to be?
It was pretty glamorous. I loved my time at Vogue, though I was the only person at Vogue who didn't have anything to do with fashion. I edited all the non-fashion part of the magazine, which was books, culture, design, travel, food. But it was pretty glamorous to be an editor at Vogue. You feel like everything just comes to you. The whole world wants you. You get invited to luxury spas and boutiques in the Spanish Mediterranean. It was a good life. It was good. It was also really hard work, but it was fun.
It sounds like the kind of job I would never want to give up. What sparked your transition to fiction?
So after Vogue, actually, I also edited a Saturday magazine for 3 years. But I had started writing my book while I was at Vogue. in 2015. So I wrote the book over 5 or 6 years. I think I always wanted to write fiction. I'm that kid who, you know, was writing short stories when I was 10 years old and forcing my grandparents to read them and writing poetry as a teen. But I don't come from a family of writers. I don't come from a family that has artists of any kind. You know, everybody's an engineer or a doctor or a teacher. So there isn't even really an academic in the family. So I didn't know. I didn't know that I could make a living or that I could be a writer. It wasn't a possibility for me. So I'm like, okay, I like writing. Let's find a career that is writing adjacent. So journalism actually felt like a great fit because I could write and I could make money and have an office and leave home every day like I've seen my parents do and go to an office and come back. So that's why I did journalism. And I must say, I think I had pretty good jobs in journalism. Vogue was amazing. And then I was editing Mint Lounge, which is kind of a really cool Saturday magazine, you know, that everybody reads. So I had good jobs, but somewhere in the back of my head, fiction was the calling. And so I started doing it alongside. And it was hard, actually, writing alongside a full-time and very demanding journalism jobs. I used to work 10 or 12 hours a day. So I wrote my book over weekends or, you know, at night between 12 to 2. But I'm pretty proud of that. So after the book was announced, I'm like, okay, now I know I can write a book. So I quit full-time journalism and I'm trying to write the second book in normal daytime hours now.
How proud is your family? You know, the doctor, lawyer, engineer family, how proud are they to see you as a published artist?
Oh, you know, they aren't the very expressive kind, but I think the fact that at least they've displayed both, you know, the Indian and the UK edition of my book in their bookshelf in the living room, I think that's a lot for them. So
that's wonderful. Yeah. So this novel is called The Illuminated. It's about a mother and daughter, Shashi and Tara. Shashi is a 50-something woman, and as the book opens, she is very newly widowed. Tell me where she's at emotionally when this book opens.
Yeah, that's such an interesting question, Claire. I feel, for me, stories start with either a visual or an emotional charge. And definitely the start of the story, for me, I actually saw the first chapter as a short story. It was entirely about this woman who has suffered some kind of loss and wants to do something for herself. She desperately wants a cup of tea. And it could be anything, but for her, it's tea. She wants, it's this kind of private solace that she seeks. And that was really the emotional charge that set off the first chapter. You know, widowhood in India or in Asia, I guess, is so ritualized. We have so many rituals around death. So when somebody passes away, you have to do this. You can't eat this. You have to dress this way. You have to greet people this way. You can't say this. You can't listen to music. There are all these rituals. And sometimes the rituals are good because it helps you to deal with your emotions in a kind of more paced out way. But sometimes they can be stultifying. Sometimes they can keep you from really feeling your feelings, so to say. So Shashi, as a 50-something widow whose husband has passed away, is expected to behave in a certain way. The world is expecting her to mourn publicly. They're expecting her to cry, grieve, bang her head on the wall. They're expecting these things. And she loves her husband. She's definitely in mourning. But her way of expressing that is more private. And the last, the past few weeks for her have been so public in that sense that she wants this private moment of solitude to think about him. And she wants a cup of tea. So I feel for her, the tea really stood for all these things that women want privately, but are kept from. So that really was what set the first chapter rolling.
Yeah, when she has the time to think about her husband, of course she does think about how much she loved this man. But this man, he had a very big personality. He's the kind of person who kind of sucked up all the air in the room. And she says to a friend in the book, she says that her husband had a good marriage and that she, Shashi, was only a small part of it. I found that so moving. What does she mean by that?
I think, you know, her husband, Robi Malik, who's the patriarch of the book, he is this typical idea of a larger-than-life narcissistic man who, like you said, sucks up all the energy in the room. So for him, he wants to have the perfect career, the perfect public life, and the perfect marriage. He is possibly not the kind of man who will, you know, abuse his wife or cheat on her. He is in many ways, on paper, the ideal husband. You know, Claire, I had women read the book and tell me, we want a husband like Robi Malik. And I was like, but what, have you read the book? What's going on? You know, but he is, for many people, he is this perfect man. But I was interested, I think, in the entire book, even in Shashi's daughter's narrative. I think when we speak about feminist identity or feminist struggles, so often we focus on, the more obvious transgressions, domestic abuse, rape, not being given a promotion, these big things that we can see. But I was interested in the what we now call the microaggressions, you know, the private humiliations, the way that it's possible for a woman as educated and privileged as Shashi to still feel that she didn't accomplish her whole potential, that she didn't live her life, because she is with a man like her husband, Robi Malik, who is simply so consumed by himself, simply so trained and conditioned by society to constantly place himself at the center of the family life, of the world, of the workplace, that they are unable to see that people around them are suffocating. So I was particularly interested in those unseen violations. And that's why I think only after her husband has passed, because while he's alive, he's this successful, powerful, loving, affectionate man. And I don't think she even had the emotional bandwidth to realize or to recognize that something is missing in her life, which is why only after he's gone, she has the space to contemplate that, hey, you know, maybe everything wasn't okay. So it was important for me to remove him from the picture so she could have that time to just to process.
Yeah, so Shashi is in Delhi processing all of that. Her daughter, Tara, well, she's physically distant. She's studying in Dharamshala. She's also quite emotionally distant from her mother at this point. Tara has fled to Dharamshala. She's run away from another dominant man, really. Can you explain Tara's backstory?
So, you know, for me, the book is also a lot about privilege. It's been described as a feminist book, but it's also about privilege, and I see gender as a privilege. So the men in the book, you know, are kind of at the center of this privilege. But now Shashi and Tara, though they share the same surname, they belong to the same family, occupy very different places in this spectrum of privilege, because Shashi comes from a modest background. She married this really rich and successful man. But their daughter Tara is the daughter of a national award-winning architect, a narcissistic man. And for her, that's an ideal man. That's the kind of man that she looks for in the world. And she is a little bit of a spoiled brat, who feels she is entitled to everything, she can get away with everything. But I think some part of her, while she does feel entitled, is also aware of her entitlement and is eager to prove her own credentials, which is why she chooses to study a rather difficult subject like Sanskrit, which really doesn't have too many takers in you know, today's contemporary academia in India. So she's chosen to study Sanskrit in a small university town. She's always grown up in a big city, but she goes to the small university town because it has a good Sanskrit department. And she is out of place there. And suddenly there is this very successful, glamorous visiting Sanskrit scholar from Chicago. He is a Kashmiri Indian, but like a lot of Kashmiris who had to leave during the exodus from Kashmir in the late 80s, he's migrated to Chicago, and he comes and he is beautiful and smart and glamorous. And I think, A, she sees her father in him, and she also kind of thinks, okay, here is someone who is worthy of my attention and time. And they begin a kind of inappropriate affair, except that to any of us, to readers, or I guess even to the students around her, there is a clear imbalance of power in this equation. But for Tara, there isn't, because she hasn't faced, as a privileged 25-year-old, she has never faced discrimination. She has never seen an imbalance of power. She doesn't realize that there is a kind of messed up dynamic in a 25-year-old having an affair with a man in his 50s who is in a position of power on the campus. So they have an affair. It doesn't go well. And she also has ego, and which is bruised. And I don't want to give away too much, but she is bruised and she needs time to process. So she takes a semester's break and goes away, across the country to Dharamshala, which is a beautiful, quiet little, very spiritual town. It's where the Dalai Lama lives in India. So it's got all these Buddhist monasteries and monks. And she is ostensibly there to study. But I think she's kind of just processing and dealing with trying to think about what happened in an intellectual way, because she is an intellectual. So that's where she is when we meet her.
Mm. I really love the parallels between the stories of these two women really trying to find their own place in the wake of these men. You have said that you were angry when you wrote this book. Can you explain that anger?
Yeah, it's a very fascinating thing, Claire, that, when you start writing, of course, you have a broad idea of what you're writing about, you know your characters, but until you're actually on the page, until you're actually typing or writing, however one writes, you don't really know what the story is going to be. So the story kind of develops as you're writing. And honestly, when I started writing the book, I didn't know it was going to be an angry novel. I didn't know I had anger in me. So in a way, I would actually think that maybe just like Shashi and Tara needed this time away or time by themselves to process, I think I needed to sit with this fiction, for 5 years to process what I have felt about just the world around me. And again, these tiny acts of aggression, small things like when Tara is a PhD student and she is a brilliant one, but when she is introduced by her dean to the visiting professor, he first introduces her peer, who is a man, and he is introduced saying he's comparing case in Latin and Sanskrit. So he is introduced with the topic of his doctoral dissertation. And then he introduces Tara, but he says, Tara is very stylish, and if you ever need help shopping around the city, she will take you out. Mm. Now, this is not something you can complain about on any Me Too forum. You can't really explain that you're offended that your dean introduced you saying you are stylish, because on the surface, it's a compliment. But as women, Claire, we know it's not a compliment. We know it is a way to undermine her scholarly ambitions. It is a way to put focus on her physical appearance or kind of sexualize her in a way. So these are things that I only began to realize as I was writing the story, as I was fleshing out the characters. I realized I had years of anger in me that I haven't expressed because I've always, even in my journalism, I work, like I said, with Vogue or a Saturday magazine. I wrote on culture and, art, but I've never been a political journalist. I haven't ever seen myself as a radical in college. I've been a proper person who went and got a master's degree, listened to her parents, got married. I did all these things that were right on paper. So I've never seen myself as an angry person. And then suddenly while writing this book, I was getting angrier progressively as I was writing it, which was fascinating. for me.
And you read a section from your book at the opening of the show, which I just loved. There is something curious about a woman's anger. A spark can set alight a whole forest once wet and green. And you talk about how this is fueled by not just them, but the women that come before them. Do you think this is part of that exactly. specificity of a woman's anger? Is this multi-generational yeah. aspect of it?
Perhaps, you know, I mean, and it's so great that you kind of just connected these two things. But I think there is a compounding that happens. Something happens to you and then you realize something similar happened to your mother or your sister. I think it kind of gets compounded also because women around the world, but especially in societies like India, so many women do not have the privilege to speak up for themselves or choose not to because maybe they have children who they don't want to destabilize, or maybe they have parents who will have a heart attack if they leave their spouses, you know, so they keep quiet. And I think the other women around them realize that they must speak not just for themselves, but they have to speak for their sisters and their friends and, you know, the women that they know who are circumstantially unable to speak for themselves. They have the power, they have the strength, they can speak for themselves. Maybe they choose not to, or sometimes they actually can't. So I feel that it gets compounded, which is why, you know, though the book has these two central characters, the mother and daughter, it really was a book about many women for me. So even the other minor characters are very important to me. And when we were thinking about the cover, you know, for the Indian edition and the edition that you have a lot of moons on the cover. And I was very keen on that because for me, it's not about two characters. It's about this kind of collective, it's a collective movement towards light. It's all these women, whether they occupy many pages in the book or small, the book is about all of them and how they all need to move together towards something. So I think, yeah, I think the word I would use is that there is a certain compounding of anger that happens when you realize that you are speaking not just for yourself.
You spoke about the moon just now. There is a bit of a sun and moon motif running through the book. The chapters are all named after moon phases. Can you explain a little bit of this?
Oh, there's so much actually, Claire. And I think this is one bit that might be lost on international audiences, but actually all the women in the book are named after various names of the moon. Shashi is means moon. I picked not very obvious names. I picked kind of offbeat words for the moon. Tara means star, but for instance, Purnima, who's another character in the book, means full moon. Shashi's grandmother is Indubala, which means little moon. So all the women are named after the moon, and Robi and Amitabh, the men, are named after the sun. And I really had this lunar symbolism in mind. I find that the power, the metaphor of light more broadly is a very powerful one. Everyone from Virgil to Rumi to Audre Lorde has used, you know, the metaphor of light. For me, I wanted to challenge the accepted hierarchy of the solar system. Why do we think of, you know, the sun as the center of the solar system and everything else just revolves around it? And I think that is what the men in the book, Robi Malik, Amitabh Dhar, they're named after the sun and they are taught to be the center. But what happens when the sun is eclipsed? Which is why it was important for me, for Robi Malik, the patriarch of the book, to die on page one, because I wanted the moons to find their own light.
I love that so much. I also, I think this is the first time I've had an author declare they wanted to challenge the accepted hierarchy of the solar system. Not a small task.
Well, I mean, not in a literal sense, in a poetic way, Claire. I don't want any scientists coming at me.
There is a foreboding presence in this novel, The Illuminated. There's a group called the MSS. This organisation is seemingly involved in everybody's business, or particularly women's business. What is the MSS?
So because this is for audiences in Australia, I will say that there is a national kind of vigilante group in India called the RSS. And they are very right-wing, and they would like everybody in India to be Hindu and worship the cow. And they do promote lynchings of our Muslim neighbors. And it's not a very pleasant scenario in India right now at all with all of this. And it's in the news. And, you know, I'm sure some of your listeners would have followed this. The MSS, loosely veiled reference, is called the Mahalakshmi Seva Sangh. And again, I think like with most vigilante groups, they start off very harmlessly. They don't start off with large political affiliations. They started off as a volunteer organization that wants to protect women. And I think as the book kind of progresses, we see that they are gaining in political power. There are more news reports in them. They have political support. And I think this is the reality of a lot of the vigilante groups that we see, not just in India, in various parts of the world now, that it starts off so small. It starts off with ostensibly some kind of a helpful connotation. They want to protect women in this case, but then it becomes seemingly more sinister. And I think this idea that women need protection in itself, just the idea of that is so patronizing. And that's one of the tools that patriarchy uses, you know, in a way to infantilize women, to tell women that this is a job you can do. This is a person you can marry. This is how you can live and cannot, because it's good for you. And there's actually resonances, I think it's briefly mentioned to a book, to an ancient Indian text called the Manusmriti, which... And I appreciate that. See, at the time it was written, perhaps some of these diktats were needed. But when politicians today or religious leaders today quote the Manusmriti, which was written centuries ago, and said things like women should not live alone till a woman is married, she's under the protection of her father. Once she gets married, she's under the protection of her husband. And after her husband dies, she's under the protection of her sons. This might have made sense 5,000 years ago. It makes absolutely no sense today. But there are people today and groups today that will evoke something like the Manusmriti to pass bills, to try to shame women who are trying to be financially independent or socially independent. So, and it's very much a reality. This isn't a, you know, it isn't a dystopic, it isn't dystopia. This is unfortunately pretty close to reality.
Does it take courage and indita to take on a group like RSS in your fiction?
What's very interesting is that the right wing in India is very mobilized on Twitter, you know, on social media, but they don't actually read books. So I don't think they've actually read the book, you know, which is why my publishers here were also very careful. They're like, let people discover the book and read it. They were very careful not to say upfront, put the political aspects of the book. Also, because it's one aspect of the book, right? The politics is one aspect that the women in the book are battling. I think it would be unfair to the book to also reduce it to, you know, purely a book about women and MSS. It isn't that. But I think my publishers were rather careful not to put it upfront in the announcements or the acquisition announcement, for instance, or the press releases, because that is what the right wing reads, unfortunately. They don't actually bother to sit down with the 300-page book and read it. So I'm safe. They're not going to listen to the podcast as well. If I tweet about it, is what really matters. So, yeah.
All right. You're in a safe space here on the ABC. I was going through the acknowledgements of your book. You thank a lot of people. One of the names that jumped out at me, though, was Jonathan Franzen. Why are you thanking Jonathan Franzen?
So, okay, cool story. I'm a huge Franzen fan, and I know somehow he's not, you know, in the last few years, he's not very popular. People see him as this kind of white male privilege holder, but I think I've always thought of him to be a fantastic writer. I love his fiction, and I think he's been misunderstood. So I interviewed him, you know, when I was with Vogue, and Franzen had come to India in 2014, I think, for the Jaipur Literature Festival, which is a huge festival, Claire, and you should come sometime if you haven't. It's, I think, one of the largest literature festivals in the world at the moment. So he had come there and I had interviewed him. And because I've read everything he's written, it was a good interview, I must say so. And he said that. He said this was a really good interview. Thank you. And that was it. When I finished writing my book during COVID, and I think some of us, I mean, truly believed that the world was ending. You know, there was one week when the New York Times had a cover image of all these mass funeral pyres in India. And I realized that I had his email because we had been introduced to set up, you know, just to connect ahead of the interview. I'm like, hey, I have nothing to lose. Let me write to Jonathan Franzen and ask if he will read my book. So I sent a pretty, I think somewhat like cocky email saying, an end of the world request. That was my subject line. Hello, and an end of the world request. And I wrote this long email saying, hi, you know, I met you 6 years ago. I interviewed you and you said it was one of the best interviews you've had. Look, I've written a novel and you're one of my favorite writers and it would just mean so much to me if you read it, but I can't even send you the book. Couriers from India were stopped at that time. This was peak COVID. So I said, I'm going to send you a PDF, but will you please read it? It's going to be something so small for you. It'll be nothing. It'll be 3 days of your life, but it will change my life and it'll change the life of the book. And I was really dramatic because, you know, a big part of me felt he's never going to read it. So this was just totally random. And then he replied in an hour saying, hi, I remember the interview and it's great to know that you've actually written a book. And I had sent him the link to the HarperCollins acquisition announcement for India saying it's their lead title for 2021. It sounded quite impressive. So he's like, this is great. You know, I can't tell you when, but I'm going to read your book. And he had his own book out at that time. Crossroads was out. And because he's Jonathan Franzen, there was a lot of travel and publicity planned around it. So he said, I have a huge pile, but, you know, I'm going to read your book. So that was that. And then I didn't want to be this person who kept, you know, following up. Have you read it? Have you read it? You feel really vulnerable and strange doing that because you feel maybe they have read it and they didn't like it. So, you know, I didn't really follow up. But then I got the physical copies of the book. So then I wrote to him saying, would you like me to mail you the copy? He said, yeah, that's always better. And then at some point, after a long time, I think almost close to a year after I had sent it to him, he did read it and he sent me his personal review on mail. And at that time, the book hadn't sold internationally. It definitely wasn't going to be out in Australia or the UK. And I was beginning to feel very pointless about my life, you know, having spent 6 years on this. And for me, just saying that I think you're the real deal. And for me, that was just better than any public blurb or better than, I don't know, a review in the New York Times. It meant everything to me. I think it gave me fuel to keep writing more. And since then, we've emailed a few times and speaking about movies for some reason more than books. But I really value this email exchange that I have going on.
That is a very cool story. Anindita Ghosh, it's been such a pleasure to meet you today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Claire. This was, you know, Claire, this was really, really a wonderful conversation. I've been speaking about this book for now close to 2 years because it was out in India 2 years ago. But I think very rarely have I had, a conversation that goes so deeply into so many what I think are kind of, you know, more hidden aspects of the book. So thank you for being such a close reader and thank you for your wonderful questions.
It's my absolute pleasure. The Illuminated by Anindita Ghosh is published by Head of Zeus. Jonathan Franzen thinks it's the real deal and so do I. Now on the book show, it's about to get gritty. Ben Hobson's third novel, The Death of John Lacey, is set in the Victorian goldfields, a place where the need for survival has replaced the need for morality. Here's the evocative beginning of the book.
In the end, he was alone. It was musty and dark in the earth, the taste of iron, dirt in the mouth. A struggle to breathe, his bad leg groaning like he was decades younger, and the injury was fresh again. His chest throbbing gunshot blood, the backs of his legs leaking. He had always known it would be this way. Deep in the bloodied ground he'd made his name on, the boy he'd murdered, reborn, he knew that now. Conspiring with the spirits, all of them bent against him. The boy manifest in every circumstance, all people. His rotten luck, not born of chance, but born of the decision he'd made all those years ago. He did not regret he had killed the boy. He regretted only he had not killed him so hard he had stayed proper dead.
Ben Hobson thinks of his book, The Death of John Lacey, as an Australian Western. I'll let him explain.
My book, The Death of John Lacey, it's set during the Gold Rush era in Ballarat. And it really centres on this man named John Lacey. And there's a bit of a spoiler in the title. He does die in the book. John Lacey is not based on any real person in history, but it's about sort of his rise and then his fall. And his rise, he's the sort of man who's very quick to not follow his moral judgment. In fact, I would say he doesn't even have a moral judgment. And in the setting and the time period, and even today, I think, as well, there's a lot of people who are rewarded for being able to make these sort of cutthroat decisions and not look with empathy or kindness towards any other human beings. And they manipulate and they scheme, and our world rewards these sorts of people. They get placed in these positions of power. And John Lacey is very much in that mold, and he's willing to do absolutely anything to get what he wants. And on the goldfields of Ballarat, it means taking advantage of anyone he can find, but especially the First Nations people in the area, the Wadawurrung people. He takes advantage of, you know, workers, people who are desperate, trying to find food for their families. Just, he's the worst person I've ever written in my life. I do see this novel as a type of Western. I've really loved Western since I was a little boy. My dad used to hand me Louis L'Amour books. My dad's not a big reader at all, but he did read Louis L'Amour. And so I've always seen it as this really adventurous, fun, adventurous, where people are really tested and pushed to their limits. And then as I grew up, I discovered Elmore Leonard. I discovered Cormac McCarthy as a big influence as well. Not that I'd say I hold a candle to those two legends, but they're huge in my reading life. They really brought a lot out of me when I was very young. And then I think it's films as well. I really like films. I really like the Western genre. There Will Be Blood, I mentioned, but I love No Country for Old Men, Unforgiven, The Assassination of Jesse James. And the thing I think that I really respond to in a Western is sort of where it really does boil us down to, if you were pushed into a corner, if you were desperate, how moral can you be? And I think that nowadays, at least from, you know, in my own experience, it's kind of a luxury to think I'll never steal, as an example, because I have, you know, I'm a high school teacher, I have money, I can provide for my family. But if my family were threatened with no food, if I were threatened, like, you know, I was starving, how far would that morality actually hold? And I think the Western does a great job of sort of winnowing us down to those moments where we have to really think, like, would I actually be able to hold true to what I believe is the right thing to do? It was actually a tricky thing to research this novel because I really wanted to travel to the area. And so when I started to do my research, I actually wrote a travel grant application, and I was all set to come down and meet the Wadawurrung artist who I was collaborating with, and I was able to, you know, go and put my hands in the river and feel the dirt. But I applied for this in January 2020. Yeah, so that meant that then obviously February 2020 happened and Victoria was shut off to me. I'm from Brisbane. And it wasn't until December last year that I finally got to go and meet Marlene, who I'd been collaborating with, and I got to actually hold the pans and swish the water and all those sorts of things. There's a fair bit of colonial violence in my novel, and the way I wanted to present that was just as authentically as I possibly could, without shying away from not only what it was but its effects. And I think there could be a version of my novel that is highly cleaned up and sanitized for people, but the more research I did and the more I worked with the Wadarang artist who I was collaborating with named Marlene, the more I talked to her, like, it was important to actually show that violence in as ugly a way as possible, because it's not a pleasant part of our history.
Ben Hobson telling us about his Australian Western, The Death of John Lacey. It's published by Allen and Unwin. And now I want you to meet Simone Lazaru. She's based in Fremantle here in WA, but she was born in Singapore to a Singaporean father and an Australian mother. And the story of her parents, the beginning and the end of their relationship, really underpins her latest novel, which is called Between Water and the Night Sky. Simone is taking you and me into her writing studio now. I love this space. I'm going to politely say that it's a little bit cluttered. It looks like there's a lot of creativity happening here.
Absolutely correct, Claire. I am in the middle of writing two new perhaps novels or novellas. I haven't decided what they'll be yet, but one of them's been long running since 2017. So you can see I have pictures of, because that one's set in Europe, so including Portugal and Venice and so on. I have little pickies of Venice up there that I got, an etching that I got there when I visited the first time. And I have books also that I used for Between Water and the Night Sky. And I also have my teaching books from 3 or 4 years ago. I taught at Murdoch University for 16 years. But this isn't all the books. All the books are in the lounge room. but yes, cluttered is the word.
So, I like it. This looks like a place where ideas are happening. There's like a whole kind of wall of post-it notes behind you as well.
Contacts, phone numbers, emails, little notes that are to myself. And when if there are things that are to do with the drafts, writing that I'm working on, I leave them there until I make sure I've incorporated them into the draft and then they go into the bin.
That is a solid filing system. You've also got some beautiful like art from your children. How old is this art up here?
No, look, that one, the happy birthday, Mum, there I am doing all the things a mother should do, but I don't think I did them all.
Pictures of using a vacuum cleaner.
Lift weights, I still haven't. But that would be, so Sophia is 32 now, so that would be, she was 8 at the time, so that gives you a bit of an idea, 10, 22, but they're kind of precious. My kids' things are precious, and the drawing in the middle is my son's. And I love having kids' art around me, and those ones are special because they're very young when they did it. So, yeah. And you can see a certificate, my father, a photograph of my father's certificate of registration as an Australian citizen, which, of course, you might remember is used in Between Water and the Night Sky, the Queen and her yellow. And so that's still there from Between Water and the Night Sky, writing that.
So that's your dad's registration as an Australian citizen.
Correct.
From 1964.
Correct. And we are on the back, simply just our tight, the siblings, my siblings and I are on the back because we migrated with him to Australia, obviously with him and Mum to Australia. So,
all right, well, let's get into the story of your parents. Yes. Because this really is the basis, I guess, for Between Water and the Night Sky. Yeah. When did your dad first come from Singapore to Australia?
Late 1950s. So that was around about 1956 from memory. He came on a scholarship, a Colombo Plan scholarship, that the Commonwealth were giving to people in Asian countries to come to universities here. And so he came to study engineering and help with the kind of rebuilding of Singapore, I guess. And that's why they were giving scholarships to want to be engineer students. So he came around about then. And my mother was always, she was born here. They would have been amongst the biggest inspirations, if you like, for the book.
The book's about photography. Do you have photos of your mum and dad in here?
I do indeed. In fact, on that chest there, I was just thinking, right, I should put them into albums. Look, this one, although it's faded, is kind of, I kind of find this one really fascinating in a way. It's very faded, but and my dad, I think, took the picture and ran in. You know, he had one of those time release cameras.
So this is a family photo.
A family photo of my father and brother and siblings and my mum right there in the background. But I have little close-up ones of her as well. That's a mugshot of me looking grumpy on the scales. But that was in Singapore, and so that's my mum.
Oh, she was beautiful.
When she was very young. And I have, more recent one there.
Beautiful woman. This family photo.
Yes.
It's quite beautiful because
it's so faded. I'm going to take it somewhere special and get it printed, you know.
Your mum's kind of looking off into the distance.
Yes. I think, she was a thoughtful woman, and it's a very characteristic pose, actually. I think she always kept that. I'm trying to find their wedding, a wedding photo, which was, and I can't find it right now. I'm really sorry. It'll be there somewhere. But it was a very unusual for its time wedding photo because it was quite rare for Australian women to marry Asian men. And the you can see the flower girl is Eurasian, Malay Eurasian, and one of the best man is Chinese, and that took place in Singapore. So I'm sorry, I haven't got that one there.
That's okay. You say it was unusual for white Australian women to be marrying Asian men. When your family came back from Singapore to Australia, did they face a lot of stigmatism?
Well, look, it was very difficult. And my father, I know, faced a fair bit of racism. He was quite dark-skinned, and I remember him coming back from work and saying, the so-and-so colleague is quite racist, you know. So the White Australia policy was still being enforced. That's why my father had a hard time coming in. But it kind of, things kind of loosened up a bit. So there were other Asian families in the late 60s. And of course it didn't get finally legislated out until Gough Whitlam's time in the early 70s. But yes, and my siblings, who look more Asian than me, more obviously Asian, had a fair bit of bullying in the playground. So yeah, so that's all. Yeah, that's how it was back then. Yeah, for us.
Is it hard to revisit that? I mean, I know you've said this is autofiction, emphasis on the fiction, but this is also
that's in the book. Some of your
family's story.
Correct.
Is it hard to relive some of this?
Look, it is. I do have the kind of, you know, the distance of years now, so it's a little easier. I have had people say to me, yes, but it's not racist anymore, is it? And I think it's less overt now, but while I was teaching at Murdoch, when COVID came, one of my Asian students suddenly didn't turn up to class, and she was a very good student, so I contacted her and she said she'd been pushed physically on the train and told to get out of here, you bloody virus. You know, that those were the words they used. So, you know, I think it's still simmering away, unfortunately. So, unfortunately.
You've also had to explore your parents' relationship, your parents' relationship to each other, your parents' relationship to you. Do you think this is a novel you could have written while your parents were alive?
Probably not. I think that's a good question. I think the fact that I'd lost them, I don't think I would have felt as compelled. The fact that I'd lost them, that they'd died, was the thing that compelled me to write about them. It was that feeling not only of wanting to pay homage, but also to memorialise, people who have who've died. That feeling of if I don't write something down about them, then that will be lost. People will forget, and my children are both very, you know, they're interested in family background and so on. So I thought, well, you know, I'll just write it for them and write it for me and maybe for my family, the rest of my family. Yes, and so initially that was how it started, and it wasn't till my friend read it that I decided, right, I'll make it something longer. Yeah.
And it was always going to be a novel. There was any temptation for it to be memoir?
Maybe. When I thought, I might see if I can develop these short stories into something longer, because it began as a couple of short stories. I contemplated it, but there for me was that problem of, you know, I just still felt that for family who remain and so on, and also even though these people are deceased, I think there are certain things that need to be kind of certain private aspects of privacy that need to be respected. So that's why I thought, right, no, autofiction, yeah.
New names.
Yes, correct, new names. Even aspects of the characters were invented or in some cases exaggerated a little. There were many interactions in the book that didn't ever, as far as I know, take place between my father and mother, because I did have to invent a lot.
So this novel, Between Water and the Night Sky, was written in this very room. Are there any rituals you follow when you sit down to write in this space?
Good. Look, many, many cups of tea.
Well, thank you for inviting me into this beautiful creative space and for sharing your novel with us. It's called Between Water and the Night Sky. It's published by Fremantle Press. This has been so lovely.
Thank you so much, Claire. It's been a pleasure.
The Book Show is made on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. Thank you so much for listening. Next time, I will be talking to Dominic Smith. He wrote The Last Painting of Sara DeVos, a book I know a lot of you loved. And I've got to tell you, his new one, it's pretty great. Until then, I'm Claire Nichols, and the biggest thank you, as always, to Sarah Lestrange. Bye.